Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's High-Skilled Immigration Program. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you will have the opportunity to ask questions during the question and answer session. You may register to ask a question at any time by pressing the star and one on your touch-tone phone. You may withdraw yourself from the queue by pressing the pound key. Please note this call may be recorded. I'll be standing by if you should need any assistance. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Mr. Stuart Anderson. Please go ahead.
Thank you for being on the call. The research we're releasing today is on high-skill immigration and can be found on our website at nfap.com. I would like to thank the Ewing Marion Kauffman Foundation for supporting the research. As many people know, America is a nation of immigrants, and that includes those who come to study at U.S. universities and work for U.S. companies. I'm going to start by discussing data we obtained from U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services on FY 2015 H-1B petitions. The data show high-skilled foreign nationals are important across the U.S. economy. An H-1B visa is in practice often the only way to hire a high-skilled foreign national to work long-term in the United States, and approximately 26,000 different U.S. employers hired at least one high-skilled foreign national on a new H-1B petition in 2015. The top companies with new H-1B petitions approved in 2015 were TCS, Cognizant, Accenture, Wipro, Infosys, and IBM, with others in the top 30, including Amazon, Microsoft, Google, Intel, Apple, Oracle, Facebook, and Cisco. Overall, new H-1B petitions approved for all employers in 2015 represent only a tiny proportion of the U.S. labor force at 0.07%. Approximately 54% of new H-1B visa holders each year earn a master's degree or higher. Some have wondered if Indian-based companies receive most of the new H-1B visas each year. However, I looked into this issue and calculated that the top seven Indian-based companies had about 14,600 H-1B petitions approved for new employment in 2015, or about 13% of the total. There are two reasons the supply of H-1B visas has been exhausted for each of the past 14 fiscal years. First, the annual limit is simply very low relative to the size of the U.S. labor force and economy. And second, the limits on both H-1Bs and employment-based green cards were set back in 1990, and since then we've had a technological revolution, including World Wide Web, social media, smartphones, and other innovations that have increased the demand for high-skilled technical labor. In general, when companies can't obtain a visa for someone they would like to hire, they place that person abroad, which encourages more investment and job creation overseas rather than in the United States. Some have argued that H-1B visa holders are hired only because they work more cheaply. However, research shows foreign nationals and H-1Bs are in balance paid the same or more than comparable U.S. workers. That does not mean some individuals are not underpaid or taken advantage of, or that Congress should not fix the employment-based green card system, since some individuals are hesitant to leave their current employer if it could affect how long they wait for permanent residence. I also looked at the charge of the H-1B visa holders were responsible for layoffs at Southern California Edison, Disney, and other companies. Examining these stories and understanding how and why U.S. companies contract out for work shows companies decide to contract out for normal business reasons, including focusing on core competencies and gaining access to new technology and solutions. Eliminating H-1B visas entirely would not reduce the instances of companies contracting out work, according to many experts on outsourcing that I've been able to interview, since the visas do not figure into company decisions on whether to contract out work. Alex Kozlov, director of content at Allsbridge, a leading management consulting firm, said, quote, I would say cutting off the H-1B visa program wouldn't really impact outsourcing overall, as the H-1B visa holders have a limited and specialized role in the outsourcing process, specifically in pushing through the transition phase. In other words, contracting out or outsourcing and potential layoffs happen whether or not H-1B visa holders appear on a company site. But I've concluded that it is the physical presence of a foreign national that spurs attention. It turns out Citizens Bank of Rhode Island did the exact same thing as companies like Disney and Southern California Edison, hiring a contractor that employs people abroad and laying off incumbent employees. Yet Citizens Bank received virtually no negative attention because no H-1B visa holders were seen on site during the transition to the new contract, since the transition was accomplished entirely via the web and telephone. And that's something we might see more of going forward. New technologies such as cloud computing and automation affect far more jobs than anything related to foreign nationals on skilled visas. To provide context, every year in America, more than 20 million people lose their jobs due to a discharge or layoff, according to the U.S. Department of Labor's JOLTS report. As for careers in high-tech fields, degrees in computer science and electrical engineering have the highest return on investment of any degrees other than a degree in petroleum engineering, according to the website Launch My Career Colorado, a web tool endorsed by the state of Colorado. The benefits to the U.S. economy in admitting highly skilled foreign nationals include raising productivity, adding to the growth of high-skilled labor, increasing wages and jobs, contributing patents, and starting successful businesses. However, despite these benefits, the second report released today goes into details about legislation that would restrict high-skilled immigration. While these bills are unlikely to come up for a vote this year, they will be the basis for future legislation and amendments and seem to reflect the current mood on immigration, at least in some quarters. As such, I just want to give the flavor of some of the provisions in these bills. S-2394, sponsored by Senators Ted Cruz and Jeff Sessions, would in effect expel international students from the United States after graduation by eliminating any way for them to stay and work in America. Just to put this into perspective, today at U.S. universities, international students represent 77% of the full-time graduate students in electrical engineering and 71% in computer science. The Cruz-Sessions bill would also bar high school foreign nationals from working in the U.S. in H-1B status if they have a master's or bachelor's degree unless they first work 10 years outside the U.S. It's fair to say this provision would virtually end high school immigration to America because nearly 90% of H-1B visa holders in recent years had a master's or bachelor's degree. The legislation establishes a minimum of $110,000 a year for an H-1B visa holder, and this would affect professors and even cancer researchers, of whom 40% are immigrants at America's top cancer institutes. While Senator Cruz and Sessions are both conservative Republicans, their bill contains multiple provisions to make it easier for trial lawyers to sue companies. If enacted, both the Cruz-Sessions bill and a bill by Senators Durbin and Grassley would in several ways violate U.S. commitments under the General Agreement on Trade and Services, which would expose U.S. exporters to retaliation. The Durbin-Grassley bill also would make it extremely difficult for multinational companies to transfer employees with specialized knowledge into the United States on L-1B visas by redefining specialized knowledge in a way that would allow few employees to qualify. And their bill would compel employers to pay high-skilled foreign national wages far higher than comparable U.S. workers, which would make things difficult for companies trying to maintain an equitable workplace. In conclusion, it's clear that if some members of Congress have their way, America might no longer be a land of opportunity for highly skilled and ambitious immigrants. Hopefully, this research will allow sober reflection on what that might mean. I now turn to Amer Awadalla, co-founder and chief technology officer of Cloudera, a San Francisco-based company employing more than 1,100 people and valued at $4.1 billion. Cloudera is known as an innovative company focused on delivering a modern platform for data management and analytics. Amer's views are frequently sought in the tech community and in public forums. He received a PhD from Stanford University, and before that, earned a BA and an MA in electrical engineering from Cairo University in Egypt. It's a pleasure to introduce Amer Awadalla.
Thanks, Stuart, for the very nice introduction. So I plan on going over three things with you guys today. The first one is my visa history and how I came to be a U.S. citizen, so my journey there briefly. And then I'll talk about my path to entrepreneurship and how Cloudera got started. And then I want to share with you what Cloudera does. I should note that the research that Stuart has published, one of the key points it highlighted was the fact that if you look at the unicorns, meaning startups here in the U.S. that either have lots of employees or have a valuation more than $1 billion, more than 50% of them have founders that were immigrants, that came here on H-1 visas and then eventually got the green card and became U.S. citizens and helped start these companies. I came here on a J-1 visa. That's the J-1 is the education. It's one type of education visas. That's when I came to Stanford. And then after Stanford, I got my H-1B visa, and from there on, I got my green card, and today I am very grateful to be a U.S. citizen. So that's briefly my visa history. Now, how did I come to the U.S.? My plan when I came to the U.S. in 1995 was actually not to stay in the U.S. That wasn't my plan at all. Ever since I was a very young boy, my dad, who is a professor of economics in Canada University, he was grooming me to also be a professor. So ever since then, my goal in life was to grow up and get a PhD and teach in Canada University, and that was my goal until I came here. When I came here, first day coming in my journey to Stanford University from the airport in 1995, I got to see all of these companies that I have only heard about back in Egypt. Companies like Oracle, like HP, like Intel, like Cisco, like Yahoo, who had just started around that time. So for me, it was like, wow, these companies actually are starting here. This is where this stuff is happening. And that was the beginning of something turning in me. It took a time, obviously, for it to turn, but it was definitely the seed. That journey from the airport was the seed of making the stuff real, that technology startups happen like that, like a couple of people get together in a garage, which is the standard Hewlett-Packard HP story, and decide on building something, and lo and behold, in a few years, it turns out to be a huge, massive company. So that was the beginning of me wanting to do something like that. And forgetting about my dad and his aspirations of me becoming a professor like him. I continued to do my PhD at Stanford, but while doing that, at Stanford itself, Stanford is a very, very, very entrepreneurial school, being in the middle of the Silicon Valley and everything else. They invite speakers from the industry all the time. So all the time you get to hear from other entrepreneurs and their journey, and their successes, their failures, what to do, what not to do. And then Stanford as well gives lots of entrepreneurship classes that describe the process and show you how simple the process is to get a company up and going. So within 3 years, my motivations shifted from I would like to get a PhD and become a professor like my father to I would like to start companies. And I started my first company out of Stanford in 1999. That was during the bubble years, for those that remember the early internet bubble years. It was very easy to raise money back then. I was working using my J-1 visa at that time and started a company called VivaSmart that was later acquired by Yahoo. Within 1 year, it was acquired by Yahoo. We were just 5 people in the company, and it was acquired for $9 million. Which was amazing for us, obviously, for such a very short time to be able to get such a valuation. And I went on to work at Yahoo, and while at Yahoo, that's where Yahoo helped me convert my J-1 into an H-1B into a green card. So the Yahoo helped a lot with that process. While at Yahoo, my father kept still telling me, Amar, you need to go back and finish your PhD. I had took a leave of absence from Stanford to start my first company. So I did do that. So I did while at Yahoo. Yahoo was very nice to help me with my tuition and help me go back and finish my PhD degree. And I did that primarily to make my dad happy, actually, and secondly, to make myself happy. I wanted to achieve that goal. But I definitely did not need it for any financial reasons or career reasons. My career was doing very well at Yahoo. In 2008, so 8 years after Yahoo acquired my previous company, that's when I left Yahoo and then founded Cloudera, the company that we have today. And Cloudera definitely by all standards is a very, very successful company. We have actually, the stats have been updated a bit since I talked to Stuart last week. We have about 1,400 employees working at Cloudera today. So that's 1,400 jobs that we help create. Now, of these 1,400, 1,000 are in the U.S. So 1,000 of them are U.S. jobs, and the remaining 400 are international in many, many countries, as we are selling our software in many locations. And then very briefly about Cloudera software and what we do, we were one of the very first, if not the first, big data software company. So we sell a platform that allows organizations to collect data of any type, shape, or form, and then extract value and insights and intelligence out of that data. We have many organizations that use us for financial reasons, how to get people to click more on ads or how to reduce fraud. But we are most proud of organizations that use us to do social good. So, for example, we have many health institutions that use our technology to predict diseases before they happen and cure patients before the disease has significant complications. We have many governments and agencies across the world, that, including the U.S. government, that use our software to track terrorists and predict events before they take place and find such incidents. So our software is helping really change the world in a lot of good ways beyond just helping the economy and helping people buy more stuff and click on ads. It's helping save lives and helping prevent disasters from taking place. So that's very briefly my journey, my visa history, my path of shifting from being a professor to being an entrepreneur, which I'm very proud of, and definitely what Cloudera is helping the world with.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Amr. Next, we will hear from Lyndon Melman, a partner with Barry Appleman Leiden. Lyndon has a great deal of experience working on immigration issues as an attorney in private practice, as a counsel to Senator John Cornyn on the Senate's Immigration Subcommittee, and as chief counsel of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. Look forward to hearing what he has to say. Lyndon?
Well, thanks, Stuart, and thanks, everyone. At the outset, let me thank the National Foundation for its unique voice in this and bringing out data that I've been working in this space for 20 years, and they continue to put out reports that are new, relevant, and I think drive this discussion. I would say the one statistic that Stuart brings out every time, and it still boggles my mind, having looked at this issue from the legislative side, from the agency side, and now at a global immigration law firm, is that there's 24,000 different employers that utilize the H-1B program. You really just have to pause on that number for a minute and recognize that even when policymakers have concern about alleged problems with the program by a few companies, it's vitally important that any changes to the program recognize how widely used it is, how many different industries it affects. And it's through that lens that you can look at some of the recent legislative proposals. So when you look at the Cruz-Sessions bill, several of the provisions are really not at all tied to any specific problems that have been brought out in the public through any government investigations, through any legislative inquiries. And yet you see broad sweeping solutions that would affect all 24,000 of those users. And to dig down into the specifics, just to draw out of the report, you have things like a ban on H-1B utilization for any employee with less than 10 years of experience. And I think Amir, you listen to his background and his experience in Silicon Valley, the idea that he would have been ineligible for a particular visa for his first 10 years of that career, I think really would have been a dead end for his path in the United States. Relatedly, the termination of optional practical training for students who study at Stanford and are at a university like that, their inability to work, contribute to that economy, and then transition to a work visa would be taken off the table. And of course, again, you're creating dead ends that have zero allegation. I mean, I, in my space, have never seen anything that either of those issues would really address the concerns that you hear Senator Sessions say he has concerns about in the program. You know, the other things that you have to watch for, I'll recognize that bill was introduced at the height of the primary season, but there are some, I call them lighter fluid provisions, which are really not intended to advance the policy debate, but really to fan the flames on the immigration issue. One provision that jumps out is that anyone anywhere in the United States who believes, not factually based, but who believes their job could potentially be eliminated, is now an aggrieved party. And under their proposal, the Department of Labor would shut down that company's immigration program at the outset of the investigation, so a guilt before finding. So you see some sweeping provisions that would affect so many different employers. Final thing from my private practice, Stuart, that we see here is you know, just the recognition that companies like Cloudera invest a lot of money in finding the right people with the right skill sets. That's not an easy process, even in Silicon Valley. And by the time they reach that point, they're not going to turn their back on that hire. And so what we see in our global immigration firm is they're going to find a way to leverage that individual's capability somewhere within the company. And it may not be in the United States if you don't get those immigration provisions right. And so when you see some sweeping provisions that affect 24,000 different employers, those companies are going to face some difficult decisions, but ultimately it's the broader economy that's likely to be hurt because those companies will find ways to make it work. So I'll pause there and turn it back to you, Stuart.
Great. Thanks, Lyndon. Well, now we'd like to open it up for questions.
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star and one on your touch-tone telephone. You may withdraw your question at any time by pressing the pound key. Once again, to ask a question, please press star and one on your touch-tone phone. We'll pause a few moments to allow questions to enter the queue. And we'll take our first question from Aziz Hanifa with India Abroad. Please go ahead.
Hi, Stuart. Thanks again for doing all these seminars and discussions. My question is to you as well as the other speakers also, in terms of sort of the paranoia that's going on vis-a-vis immigration, specifically H-1Bs and also then outsourcing, et cetera, and also some of the bills that Sessions and Cruz, et cetera, have introduced. And, of course, it is pandering in a sense to the primary season. But in terms of even the fees that have been levied on firms that sort of bring in H-1B, especially from India, what does it all augur in terms of the future? Because even Hillary Clinton has got to be a little defensive on immigration because she is being hit with outsourcing, H-1Bs, et cetera. So how does it all augur for some of the firms which I believe necessarily still need a lot of qualified H-1B workers?
Well, I guess I could take it first. I would say right now we obviously have seen a lot of negativity. I've tried to present kind of a balanced approach where I've talked about in some research the contributions and then also tried to have addressed, some of the concerns that people have had. I think these things, have obviously been flamed and there's obviously political interest. And it is interesting, though, with the unemployment rate under 5%, you've seen the level of populism on some of these issues. The idea that, that people wouldn't be able to get jobs or they would be able to get jobs if it wasn't for, for foreign nationals, no matter how highly skilled the foreign nationals may be. I still come back to the sort of the broader economic points and what Lyndon referred to and really Amir referred to too when he talked about that they're, that they're, even though they're a fairly young company compared to other companies, they're a global company, and that, if you're not going to allow companies to invest in the U.S. and people they want to hire, you're going to end up seeing more of the work go outside the U.S. That's not because companies aren't patriotic. It's because companies need to stay in business and they need to, to do the work they need to do to serve customers. And so, if some of these types of provisions were to become law, I think you would see, just more jobs and investment moving outside the U.S. And that would be unfortunate because not only on economic terms, but part of the culture of America is the American dream, and what Amir was talking about, how you can come here, maybe not even expecting to be part of the American dream, and then still achieve that.
Yeah, and this is Amir. I'll also add that this is happening already. So for Cloudera, because of how long the H-1B cycle is today, like even today, we're not happy with how the H-1B cycle is. It's a very, very long cycle, and companies now need to move at much higher speeds than ever before, and because of the lack of highly technical skills and the very high competition, we were forced to start hiring outside of the U.S. So when it comes to engineering and R&D, so for the first 7 years, we are 8 years old right now. For the first seven years, all of our R&D was focused here in the U.S. Between the Bay Area, Austin in Texas and the East Coast, but then we started not being able to hire technical skills, the high skilled technical folks that we need, and we were forced to open a new location last year in Budapest in Hungary. And one of the reasons why we chose Budapest, Hungary, was their access to European markets and how much quicker somebody from another country can move in and be hired in that location. So if anything, I would say the H-1B process needs to be moved in a faster direction, not in a slower direction like was what's being proposed.
Great. We can go to next question.
Once again, to ask a question, please press star and one on your touchtone phone. And we'll take our next question from Greg Siskind with Visa Law. Please go ahead. And it sounds like he has us on hold. Are you there, Greg?
Oh, sorry. Can you hear me now?
Yes. Go ahead and ask
okay.
your question.
Apologize. So, you know, one of the problems you've highlighted in past reports, I see kind of intersecting with this, which is the, particularly with the per-country quotas, you know, with the, I'm not sure what the statistics are right now, but it's been in the past, I think as much as 50% of the H-1Bs are going to Indian nationals, which is a sign of, you know, the great workers that are available from that country. But when it comes time to, you know, once workers are here for a few years, oftentimes they want to stay in the United States after they've made their lives here, and they're facing in the EB3 category, you know, waits of, I don't know what you've estimated, of like 75 years, a crazy number on there. And in the EB2 category, for example, I do a lot of work with doctors. The waits are more than 10 years. I think it's like 13 years for a physician. And that's about 25% of all the physicians in the United States come on visas and usually work through the H-1B program at one point. I guess what my question is the H-1B seems like it's a, you know, it's a visa that's appropriate probably for, you know, 5, 7, 8, 9 years, but a lot of people are now having to stay on H-1B visas potentially for decades, and I'm just wondering what your thoughts were regarding potentially, you know, new ideas where the H-1Bs, after a certain period of time, workers become free agents and essentially can work for whoever they want while they're eventually waiting, you know, waiting through the green card process. I know there's a lot of frustration in the skilled worker community, the Indian skilled worker community, that essentially, you know, having to stay on an H-1B for years and years and years gives them a lot less job. You know, they're not able to really move through their career and earn the kind of money that they would make if they were completely untethered from having to have employer sponsorship for decades on end. So I don't know if you had any thoughts about how that factors into some of the policy ideas that are being discussed.
Well, it's a great question, Greg, because, I mean, we've seen, I mean, you know, the waits that people have to endure to get on with their life are just extraordinary. I mean, speaking as an American who, you know, doesn't even like to wait in line 5 minutes when I go to a movie theater to buy a ticket, I can't imagine, you know, the way people are able to wait, you know, really many, many years. And then you're right, I've estimated that potentially the wait time for an Indian in the third preference could be 7 decades. That's on paper. Obviously, we aren't going to get people waiting that long. You know, I think it would be great to look at some alternative ways, certainly at a minimum allowing people to get employment authorization documents after some period of wait to be able to go work anywhere while they're waiting for their green card. You know, there could be other ways of doing H-1B altogether where get rid of all this bureaucracy and give people work permits and then, you know, they would be the same as, say, when people come in as and they get temporary protected status from a, you know, from a foreign country because of something bad in their homeland. You know, they get temporary protective status, they get an employment authorization document, and they can go work wherever. So I'm all in favor of any of these ways to improve mobility, and I'm sure Amr would say that, you know, for a good employer, they don't mind, you know, if the person has mobility because they assume that they'll be able to attract these people.
Yeah, I certainly agree.
Lyndon, did you want to touch on this? Because you have clients, obviously, in these situations.
Yeah, I think, Greg, it remains the, I think, top concern of companies, both out of real concern for their workforce, the morale of their employees. They're already here, so from a policy perspective, you want to increase mobility and increase their chance to succeed. I think it's an issue that has been somewhat complicated in the past, and so as the debate goes forward, I think as folks understand it better, it's the comfort level increases. So I continue to remain optimistic that if you look at various legislative solutions, the green card backlog remains at the top of the list.
Thank you.
And once again, to ask a question, please press star and one on your touch-tone phone. And it appears we have no further questions at this time.
I'm going to ask one more question to Amr. Sometime during the debates and hearings, sometimes you'll hear people get so wrapped up in concerns about immigrants taking jobs, as the argument goes, that they'll actually discourage young people from going into high-tech fields. What's your impression? Would you recommend people to go into high-tech fields?
Oh, I absolutely recommend people go into high-tech fields for a number of reasons. So the first one, we are in the middle of the big data revolution, but also the artificial intelligence machine learning revolution that's happening right now is huge. It's really one of the biggest shifts that we have seen in the last few decades. And it's creating demand, off-the-charts demand. And this is across all industries. So this is not just something specific to companies in the Silicon Valley. This is we have farmers now that need to be able to leverage data in new ways to figure out how to optimize the yield of the crops they are generating. We have pharmaceutical companies who need to be able to go over DNA genomic sequences and analyze them in much more deeper ways. We have manufacturing companies that want to predict the failures of their machines before the machines fail. It's happening across every single industry. The demand is highest than it has ever been, and that's why we are forced to do this. That's why we are forced to try and get people over here with H-1B visas, or go and like Caldera did, open an office in Hungary, Budapest, to find these people, because there is not enough. There absolutely is not enough. That's number one. And number two, yes, I would love for all of my children to be in this space, because I know that this space is only growing. The future need for people with high technical skills when it comes to data analytics and artificial intelligence and machine learning is going to be off the charts. And since the need for them is going to be off the charts, obviously the salaries they will get, the income and the lives they can sustain will be very, very good. So yes, highly advise people to go down that path. No question about it.
Great. Thank you. If we don't have any further questions.
Okay. And there are no further questions.
Okay, well, thank you, everyone, for participating in the call. And the call has been recorded and will be on our website, along with the research that we discussed today at nfvp.com. Thank you, everyone.